a random Android phone does like 100 megabytes of tracking a day.
Wow.
And on Wi-Fi at least. And that's a stunning amount of data, even if you don't, and we don't know what's in there. Even banks, Dutch banks, all of them have turned on Google Analytics or the equivalent in their apps while you are signed in. Governments are, with one mouth, they are saying, well, we want to have this open stuff that is European values, and we would actually love it for, to actually be European and not big tech. And then there's the actual spending mouth, the spending angle, where they say, we want Microsoft all the time. Not only did we do the explanation, we made it available in under such, well, such clear terms that many people in the EU could say, this is a bad idea and this is why.
Yeah.
I understand it now.
Yeah.
I feel it in my bones why it's a bad idea.
Mm-hmm. My guest today is the extremely talented Bert Hubert. Bert was founder of PowerDNS. He's worked for Dutch intelligence agencies. He's author on a whole variety of topics ranging from DNS encryption to climate change to reverse engineering the Pfizer vaccine. And he's also a very well-known member of the internet community. Following on from some of Bert's recent work on questions around personal data, outsourcing, and internet governance, we got together to talk more about privacy and who, if anyone, has control over the internet. I'm Alan Davies, the Ripe Labs editor, and this is the Ripe Labs podcast. Thank you very much for coming, first of all. Really appreciate you being here. Maybe you could start by telling us a bit about your career. So you founded PowerDNS. You've been an active member of the internet community for some years now, but you've also worked for Dutch intelligence agencies, right?
I did. So I had three big stints within Dutch government. Mm-hmm. So, like I said, my sort of career is a big word for it, but I was alternated between being this open source technology guy. Then I worked for the intelligence agencies in the Netherlands for 3 years. And then I built all kinds of software for police and intelligence agencies. And then I took up PowerDNS again, which is very much a sort of open source community thing.
Yeah.
And that's also what I really like.
Yeah.
And then after PowerDNS, because I did PowerDNS for like 20 years, and that's enough. Because like I said, I have a broad range of interests. And then all of a sudden there came a job came available in the Netherlands for oversight of the intelligence agencies. And specifically, they needed someone that was good with the technical bits, but also had an affinity with the world of intelligence. And it was like, yeah, that's me. So I did that for nearly 2 years. Then they changed the law, at which point I didn't like it anymore.
Yeah.
It's a longer story in itself.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the upshot is I've been in government, I've been out of government, I've been really part of the internet community. And that helps me bridge that gap.
To prepare for this today, I've really enjoyed reading a lot of your articles and going back over presentations. And it looks, because there are so many different things you covered, and you've got interests in biology, and you wrote on this paper about the Pfizer vaccine as well. Is there kind of a common thread going through all?
Yeah, there is a big one going through, and it's. So George Orwell, the famous writer, he once wrote a piece called Why I Write.
Okay.
And it's an extremely honest piece. And he says there are like four reasons why people write. And he mentions two of them I feel very strongly about. One of them is that like writing stuff, explaining stuff to people is a tremendous kick. Like I'm uncovering this for you.
Yeah.
And I'm explaining this important thing to you. And like that could be the vaccine, that could be DNA, that could be threats to the internet, whatever. But it is an innate satisfaction of just sitting down and writing up how at least you feel it is. And then having all these people read that and saying, well, thank you for telling it like it is.
Mm-hmm.
That is sort of, that's a very, it does feel like sort of selfless that you're doing this as a favor to the world,
yeah.
But it's also just tremendous fun and great satisfaction in doing it.
Yeah,
and that's a big theme through what I do. Very often I end up explaining things, and mostly I don't add anything novel to that. Mostly it's just uncovering what is already there, except it's hidden in 25 different pieces, or some things are just like so big that you don't immediately see them yourself. And I get a tremendous kick out of just doing explaining that. The other thing, and that's also from George Orwell, is that, and that's like maybe for the past few years, is that if you explain things really well, you can have an influence on how the world develops. And for example, like 3 years ago or something like that, the European Union decided to regulate the whole world of computing. And in their wisdom, they had decided to include the DNS root servers in that. And that was like a stupendously bad idea for many reasons. RIPE thought it was a bad idea. Many people thought it was a bad idea. But no one managed to explain to the EU why it was such a bad idea. And then together with a coalition of wise people, including ISC, the maintainer of the bind name server, we banded together and decided to just very clearly explain to the EU how the internet works and how the DNS root servers work and why it would be a terrible idea to bring that under the same legislation as, let's say, banks or whatever. And interestingly enough, that worked. So not only did we do the explanation, we made it available in under such well such clear terms that many people in the EU could say this is a bad idea and this is why.
Yeah.
I understand it now.
Yeah.
I feel it in my bones why it's a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the things, for example, when I explained the mRNA corona vaccines, that was a one idea, it was tremendous fun to do. Just to be honest about that, it was a lot of fun to figure it out. And there were lots of scientists that were willing to help and explain me how it worked. But the underlying idea was, if we educate these 2 million geeks, because the piece has been read 2 million times, which is a lot.
Yeah.
If we get all these people that truly understand how the vaccine works, and if they are in a room where someone says, yeah, no one knows how the vaccines work, they go like, I do.
Yeah.
I just read about that, and you can read about it too. Yeah. And that sort of inoculates the society against people that go around, it's full of children's blood or whatever. No, it's not full of children's blood. It's full of this mRNA stuff. I read about it here. Okay. So that was a very conscious attempt to not only explain all this cool stuff, but generate this horde of nerds that would then go on and tell everyone else that they knew how it works. And that, I think that if the feedback, and it's interestingly enough, in internet circles, I'm maybe known for PowerDNS or the RFC or some other things I wrote. Outside of that world, they're like, oh, you're the mRNA guy.
Cool.
So the effect is waning a bit now, of course. But at some point, I really couldn't enter a room and people were like, oh, you're that guy.
Yeah.
A room full of geeks.
Sure. Yeah. So going back a bit, you've worked in DNS and you talk about encryption and privacy. But you've also, in your work for the government, you've also come at this from the surveillance side of things.
Yeah. And it sets up some tension.
Mm-hmm.
And but that tension is apparent even within intelligence agencies, because on one end they are tasked with decrypting the world's communications and spying on people, but within the same building there is also a department that tries to prevent that. So the tension in there is that you'd like to have the world's best encryption and everyone should be super protected, and on the other hand the hackers of that same agency are like, hey, you're helping us out of a job. But that tension with the outside world, and it's not easy one to bridge, because you want to keep the world safe by encrypting everything. However, both sides tend to be naive in that way. So many government policy people would believe that if the police could only just access all the data, we would be perfectly secure, because they could then do their job better. And they feel that they are held back by these civil liberties things. And they also think like, look, we're nice people, we're good people here.
Yeah.
So you can give us all these capabilities and powers, but we're not going to abuse that because we're the good people. And then on the outside world, and by the way, this is of course naive that they think that way, but many of them honestly feel that way. On the outside world, there are the people that like, we should encrypt everything. Everything should be totally anonymous. We need anonymous payments. We need perfect end-to-end encryption of everything, where no one should be able to track and follow anything. And that attitude persists until your bike gets stolen.
Yeah.
And the police goes like, yeah, we have no camera. And like, what do you mean you have no camera?
Yeah.
And you should be tracking my bicycle 24/7. and of course, that's also, I mean, so there is a sort of bridging. And one particularly, I I was invited to the European Parliament to do a 9-minute presentation on this subject. Mm-hmm. And I worked really hard on it. And it has become a pivotal moment, that presentation, because there I juxtaposed these two worlds. And I was lucky enough that the speaker before me was his thesis was that, look, police should just do their investigations offline.
Right, okay.
Because online we should all be free. And they should just do their investigations in bars and restaurants and I don't know. And I could follow that up with this balance talk. I said, look, it would be wonderful if we if law enforcement knew as much about the world as Google, they could likely solve most crimes in the same day. Which is a very weird thought, if you think it through. That Google actually knows far more mm-hmm. about us than the police do. And they could literally solve most crimes with the data that they have. And they're not doing that. They're doing all kinds of other things with that data, but this is what they're not doing.
Mm.
And so it's interesting to sort of juxtapose these two worlds and see how both worlds could learn a lot from each other.
I'm glad that you mentioned that talk, because the question that I want to get into today is about how much control we have over the internet, and particularly over our own privacy. Starting with the users first, how much responsibility do we have for protecting our own privacy?
Yeah, so there in the 1990s or 1980s, maybe in the Netherlands, we became conscious of the environment
mm-hmm.
and pollution and stuff. And at one point, the government came up with the slogan, "A better environment starts with you." And later it turned out that that slogan was influenced by big oil and big mm-hmm. big chemical companies, because they were like wonderful. It's like, it's not us that's polluting the world. It's you with the plastic bags and the straws.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And actually, we fell for that. We really fell for that. And in the same way, trying to tell people, look, you need to mind your privacy on the internet, it's the same way. Like, more privacy starts with you, which is ridiculous, because you have to fight a nonstop fight.
Yeah.
If you want to have any semblance of privacy, you would probably spend an hour a day turning off switches again that have miraculously turned on again.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, in lawsuits, Google testified that even Google employees were surprised to find that their location was being tracked, despite them asking in several toggles and sliders to not do that.
Yeah.
So right now, you cannot ask normal people to guard their privacy, because they would have to be like rocket scientists to make that happen. And not only is that the case, we also blame users for getting hacked and compromised because they clicked on the single wrong link. But as an industry, we have furnished people with equipment that apparently just breaks if you press one single wrong button.
Yeah.
We would not accept that from our oven or something like that. That if you put your oven to an odd number of degrees and you turn it on, that it explodes in your face. And then we double people, you should never do, you should only do even temperatures.
Sure, yeah.
Then you know.
Yeah.
And so the end user right now is nearly powerless.
Mm-hmm.
End users can make it far worse, of course, by installing this and that and every app.
Mm-hmm.
So you can still say, look, to try not to install this app that you got with your toaster,
yeah,
or whatever, and don't buy a toaster with Wi-Fi. So we can, of course, people can make it worse, but I think it's out of the box experience. If you just get a new phone, be it an Android or an Apple phone, it will start tracking you the moment you turn it on.
Yeah.
And we cannot have a world where we have to tell people 24/7.
Yeah, no, and just the sheer extent of what's being tracked now by the various devices that you can.
It is huge,
yeah.
And it never disappoints. So whenever you look into it,
mm-hmm.
you're like, how bad could the tracking be? Well, for one thing, for example, Android phones, they try real hard to prevent you from figuring out what data they're sending to Google. So you have to do real hard work.
Yeah.
You can measure the volume. That's easy to do. And it turns out that a random Android phone does like 100 megabytes of tracking a day.
Wow.
And on Wi-Fi, at least. And that's a stunning amount of data, even if you don't, and we don't know what's in there. So there's this university in Ireland, Trinity College, and they have a sort of annual project where they take an Android phone and really make it fess up.
Yeah.
What are you sending to Google? And every time they do that, they discover that it's worse than anyone thought.
Yeah.
And even worse than Google thought. Because they habitually contact Google and say, look, we found out that you're sending these air pressure data.
Yeah.
Which you're probably using to figure out which floor someone is on. And, And Google is like, oh, we didn't know. Oh, we didn't know. And the worst thing is, I'm pretty sure that the people that are saying, oh, we didn't know, that they actually didn't know.
Yeah.
But of course, the big Google knew. Apple does something similar, except a lower volume and sort of more gracefully.
Yeah. Yeah.
Less in your face. But even an Apple phone, if you buy it, the tracking sliders are on.
Yeah.
And you have to actually get to work to find them and turn them off.
Mm-hmm.
But the volume is just is staggering.
So moving on from users then, what about companies? One of the really interesting things that you're talking about in a lot of these same talks is how the understanding of what's going on in their devices and the products that they're making is slipping away even from those companies. And yeah, that's quite scary.
Yeah, so there are a number of reasons why they're happening.
Yeah.
One thing is just that there's sort of many, so software is built in frameworks.
Mm-hmm.
Many of these frameworks contain their own telemetry services. So they start sending data to Facebook, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And in return, you get some nice statistics and other stuff if you want. But because the tracking happens in these frameworks, and also it's slanted, so it's skewed. So all these devices are sort of like tracking by default. You'll have to do work to make it stop.
Yeah.
And many people really honestly don't know anymore what is in these apps. So there might, for example, be another advertising framework in there, or there is some location service provider in there, or there is some AI as a service in there. And if you look at a modern piece of software, if it's NPM generated or Node.js, as they call it, 1,600 dependencies is like normal, 1,600. And also that number changes by the day. So every day you install the software, there's a different number of dependencies.
Okay.
And there are also different dependencies. And each of these might have decided to add a bit of tracking to your life. And if you ask someone, so what do you ship? What is in your software? Then most modern developers will say, well, yeah, it's that question is too difficult to answer.
Okay.
And that means that, yeah, it's hard to believe, but I went so, interestingly enough, so I'm not really a web guy, even though I do program websites sometimes. And I got invited to talk at a web conference, a web developer conference, a JavaScript conference, a PHP conference. And because a friend of mine, and he thought my sort of view on things would be interesting for the listeners there. And it was. But I also spent a day at that conference.
Right, okay.
Yeah. And so that also allowed me to say, look, where do these 1,600 dependencies come from?
Yeah.
And many in the audience were like, well, it has always been like this. But of course, it has not always been like this.
Okay.
So these days, if you have an app and you ask what kind of tracking is it doing, honestly speaking, you need like these people from Trinity College that reverse engineer that for you. Because one of the things that I worry about, that even banks, Dutch banks, all of them, have turned on Google Analytics or the equivalent in their apps while you are signed in. Which means that every time you transfer money, it gets sent to Google. I'm not exactly sure what gets sent to Google, but I can also tell you, no one is exactly sure what gets sent to Google. And if you ask these banks, why are you doing this? Well, the other ones are doing it. And we had a contract, and in the contract it says it's fine. And that's sort of where the scrutiny ends.
What can companies and providers do to actually mitigate these issues?
That's a good one. So first they have to want to do it. Most companies are not that good with computers, and most of them have many failed projects.
Okay.
So the focus right now, really, for lots of places is that keep it simple, get it out of the door.
Right, okay, yeah.
And that means that you don't get a lot of questions about other things.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say someone shows up with these conferences is a great example. Someone has a conference and they need a meeting app, and an advertising agency delivers that app, and it stays installed on people's phones because they forget to deinstall it. And at that time, the only worry for people was the conference starts at May 1st. Mm-hmm. The app needs to be ready the week before that. That's the entire worry. No one at that point is going to say, can we do an audit to see what is coming out of this app?
Mm-hmm.
No, we have a conference. And so the first step is people really have to want to care. This in their apps, and right now they don't really care. Of course, no one wants to be blatantly violating people's privacy or their security. Because you can imagine that an app that leaks your location to the world, that's just, it's not just a privacy danger, that's just dangerous. So people really do have to care, and they don't really. And they might also not even have any agency in that. Let's say you say, I have my conference, and it's being organized by this conference bureau. This is the app that we get. So there's nothing, you even if you would ask, say, can you take a look at it? They go like, no, because that's built by the advertising agency that works for the conference agency. And we don't even know. We put our logo on it, but that's the extent of our involvement.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing. So first, you have to care. And secondly, you have to be in a position that you can actually do it. Because most companies these days, most organizations even, have said, look, we hate this technical stuff because we've been burned by it.
Yeah.
And you have to realize, and this is a very key point, if you are in any position of power, and there are two options. One of them, my own people own something and mm-hmm. they build something, or I outsource the whole thing. So in the first scenario, if it breaks, it is your fault. Where your people messed it up, your people delivered garbage, you are on the hook for the whole thing. However, if you outsourced it from a board of directors standpoint, you can say, look, we had a signed contract that said it would be okay. So you have sort of an administrative firewall between you and the failure. That is mega attractive. Because you said, look, we picked a professional vendor, they signed a contract that said that the privacy would be good. It was Article 12 of the contract. And they violated that. And then you can come out sort of looking good as a board. They go like, well, we're never doing business with these people again.
Mm-hmm.
And when the alternative would be, we have this guy, John and Alan, and they worked. They're fine people, but they messed it up. And now it's your problem. And this essentially goes on in all of industry. This is like nothing new. It's probably the Romans probably wrote about this issue. But it's very attractive for directors to say, let's just outsource this stuff. Because especially if you're not yourself comfortable with that. So it's very instructive also. If you want to, because technical people, we really don't get this. We're like, how could you not do this yourself? Mm. It's very instructive to take something that you yourself are terrible at. It's like, you should be making the, the t-shirts.
Yeah.
Or you should be writing music or whatever, mm-hmm. something that's like really not your thing.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to like, look, you are going to organize the music. And you're like, that's not me. I don't know how it works. And you're all your hunches are there. Let's get someone else to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens in these boards of directors. They're fundamentally non-technical people there, really don't like technology. And for them, it's very easy to pick, let someone else do this.
Yeah. Would you say that's one of the main drivers to outsourcing? I mean, it's not maybe the only one, but that...
No, there actually is another one, but it's sort of related. But I want to sort of follow up a little bit on the first bit.
Mm-hmm.
Why are these non-technical people in management?
Yeah.
And it has been said that the downside of engineers is they get distracted by their subject field. Because we so like doing this internet stuff. We spend all, many of us would love to just spend all day doing internet stuff. Which means that if we have meetings, we try not to go to meetings. We try to get out of meetings. But those meetings are where the decisions get taken. Which means that when people pick directors or senior managers or whatever, the nerds never showed up.
Mm.
And they're like, they don't even like this stuff. And that's how you end up with all these musicians and historians and legal people in your board. But you ask, are there any other reasons why this is going on? And yes, one of these is like many boards want to do the fashionable thing.
Mm-hmm.
They want to do what everyone else is doing. And at one point, especially in the telecommunication industry, consultants started figuring out that, look, all these telcos, they're full of former state employees, really expensive. And if you outsource stuff, you can hire cheaper people. So these consultants, they started writing these think pieces. So they said, look, if you're not outsourcing stuff, you're just wasting money and time. And then initially on your profit and loss sheet, it looks like really good, this outsourcing stuff. And then everyone followed suit. So most companies are not doing anything original.
Mm-hmm.
Most companies would love to just do exactly what everyone else is doing. And then at one point, these Price Waterhouses of the world started just writing these reports that says this is the outsourcing percentage of each of these telcos. And would say this is Vodafone, this is Deutsche Telekom, British Telecom, KPN, and they would point like this is the loser because they're not outsourcing enough. And we are recommending, and this is the other key point, who are the shareholders of these big places? They're like pension funds mostly, mm-hmm. or index funds. And they are not in the long-term future. They just like, I want our portfolio to just be sort of nominal and do what everyone else is doing. And that's outsourcing.
Okay, so the users haven't got control. It sounds like the companies are kind of giving away control for very rational reasons. But there's luckily another party here that can help us. There's the governments, right? Yeah. And how much can government intervention help?
How do you see their role in this?
Oh, it's super interesting. Yeah. So, naively speaking, people would say, well, the government should outlaw this stuff.
Yeah.
But that's a very blunt instrument. But it's often what people want because it's like very straightforward. Say, look, so in the EU, and I haven't followed this very closely, so I might be getting this wrong, but they have a thing called the EU cloud certification scheme.
Yeah.
And there are people in there that are willing to say that, look, European governments can only buy European clouds from now on. And that's just a terrible way. That's protectionism. You should not just be outlawing things.
Yeah.
You should also be encouraging good things.
Right.
And that is where I far more see the power of governments. Because in most countries, the government is the largest buyer of IT services. Which makes sense, because if you have like 18 million people paying taxes, that's a lot of files.
Yeah.
And so in most countries, the government actually has huge influence that it doesn't need to use the law for. It can just say, we are now buying these good technologies.
Right,
okay. That have values that we like and that are under our control. Mm. And in that case, the government is actually sort of stimulating stuff just by deciding where it spends its money.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, you see the government as a regular organization. It's just buying a ton of IT stuff. Yeah. It's really shocking how much that is. But they are exactly not doing that. This is exactly what they are not doing. Governments are, with one mouth, they are saying, well, we want to have this open stuff that is European values, and we would actually love it to actually be European, and not big tech. Mm. And so that's the policy angle. That's at least true for the European government and the German government. And then there's the actual spending mouth, the spending angle, where they say, we want Microsoft all the time. For all the things. Right now, for the Dutch government, it's so bad, if Microsoft sold shoes, they would be buying Microsoft shoes. Because they're just happy with the arrangement. And so, but this is where you see the difference between the policy and then the people that are actually in procurement who are not connected.
Okay.
They're in different buildings.
Yeah.
They don't care. So one of the things I would love for governments to do, because they spend like billions on it. So in Europe, I think governments probably spend like 100 billion euros a year on IT. If you just add up all the things, like, and 100 billion euros is like real money.
Sure.
Let's say you would earmark like 100 million.
Yeah.
Which is like less than 0.1% of that. I would say we would like to get just one thing, independent email and calendaring. We just want to have one alternative to Microsoft. And we're going to spend 0.1% of our IT budget on it. Can you imagine what we and our friends in the open internet, what we could build for 100 million euros? We could build a temple of email and communications, and it would be the best email communications and video conferencing solution. 100 million euros, which is still like peanuts. Yeah. In the grand scheme of things. And but we're not doing it. So procurement law is a very formal thing.
Okay.
So you have to describe the aspects of what you want. So let's say you want to buy a car using formal procurement. You can say, look, it needs to be this energy efficient, must be available in the following colors. But you cannot say it must be a Peugeot.
Right, yeah, sure.
You can only say it must have the following characteristics. For software, the Dutch government is now procuring Outlook licenses.
Hmm.
So they're saying, who can sell us Outlook licenses? Which is like ordering the Peugeots. It's not saying we need email with the following characteristics. We say, no, we need the actual Outlook. And this breaks all kinds of procurement law. But the thing is, I cannot really blame these people Because what else would you be buying right now?
That's really interesting. But I'd also like to go back and talk about some of the government directives and regulations that are really supposed to help the situation. At the start of the conversation, you talked about how the internet community had to push back on some of these because they were in conflict with the way that the internet is currently being run. Or are we reaching a point where the tech community and the governments are actually beginning to get an understanding of each other, where...
Yeah, I'm slightly optimistic.
Yeah?
So we are coming from a place where there was only accidental contact.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of course. So yeah, if you go to Brussels, which really is the headquarters where all this legislation is coming from, you see Microsoft, Google, Apple, Meta, they all have big offices within walking distance of mm-hmm. where it happens.
Yeah.
And that's not because they like Brussels so much. So the big tech has and tech in general, but mostly US big tech has been very present.
Mm.
And you have to realize that on the one hand, lobbying could simply be about pressuring people or maybe even sort of, I wouldn't say bribing, but sort of painting a bright picture if you follow certain suggestions. But even if you disregard all that, simply being there and talking a certain language, speaking certain language, influences the thought of legislators.
Okay.
So if you start talking about privacy in certain terms, that will eventually influence the people that write the legislation. Mostly, until like, I think a few years ago, this was the entire influence on Brussels. So you would be inundated in power breakfasts organized. So many American organizations, even Mozilla, the people behind Firefox, they would hold policy breakfasts in which all kinds of policymakers would be invited. You'd get a presentation on all the great work on privacy or whatever that the Americans were doing, and they so value our privacy so much that they, I don't know. But they were able, I think they were able to paint a picture that says we care. Then with NIST2, we had a coalition of people that had contacts.
Yeah.
And I think for them it was like a sort of very interesting change of scenery, because suddenly people showed up that just said, look, this is harming the internet in these concrete ways.
Mm.
And that eventually reached the right people. And with NIST2, that happened a little bit for the root servers and a few other things.
Yeah.
For the Cyber Resilience Act.
Yeah.
So maybe good to paint this picture. NIST2 is about everyone that provides services. CRA is about the software and the devices with which you provide those services.
Mm-hmm.
So they complement each other, these two acts. And the CRA is like very brave and courageous and novel. These are words that policy people don't like, by the way. And eventually, I lost track of how many people were able to voice their thoughts to the European Commission.
Hmm.
I keep discovering more organizations that were able to get their viewpoint across.
Okay.
And this has been a lot better. So at one point, it looked disastrous, like utterly disastrous for the open source community. The CRA would just kill open source in Europe. And then people from NLNet Labs and myself and the Eclipse Foundation and RIPE and all kinds of people managed to get the ear of policymakers.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, and everyone should keep this a secret, the CRA is like lovely for open source right now.
Right.
It is wonderful for open source.
Yeah.
And it's a disaster for everyone else. But for once, this is good. But don't tell anyone. This is our little secret.
So you would say they're both kind of victories, in a way, these two?
Yeah, I think for CRA, eventually it was a victory, although it's very difficult. I mean, we know from the world of internet standards making how hard it is to write an RFC.
Yeah.
And how many people get involved and how difficult it is to reach consensus.
Mm-hmm.
And writing an EU act is exactly like that.
Okay.
And so it would have been better if the internet community would have been involved from an earlier moment in time. But it is the same terror. It is the same terror that you see at IETF meetings where there's endless talks. But it is getting better.
You are talking about things from an EU perspective. And when we're thinking about control, it seems that the flow is going from the EU towards America, essentially. In connection with that, one of the things that you've written about recently is the SIDN Labs decision to move its services, or some of its services, to the AWS cloud. What's the outroar about there? Why was that such a worrying case?
So what we're seeing, so SIDN is the registry of .nl, and many companies in the world make use of American clouds. And that is not in itself a terrible thing, because these clouds, they deliver valuable services, they can be very reliable. And but it's still pretty nice if you are not fully dependent on the three main US clouds. What we are seeing in a broader way is that specifically all Dutch organizations, but I think it's a broader European thing, they have sort of decided to standardize on AWS from Amazon and Azure from Microsoft. And that is now becoming the only choice in many places. And what rankled is that SIDN put out a proud release where they said, we are going to move all the things to Amazon Web Services. And they also said, we think that soon everyone will do that, and we can switch off our last server. And that struck people the wrong way.
Yeah.
So it's one thing to say, look, we're using these clouds because some of their services are very good.
Yeah.
It's another one to go out and say, look, we're turning off every last of our servers because it's the future.
Yeah.
Then SIDN came back a bit, saying, no, we didn't quite mean it like that. But they did say it like that. And to this day, this is their statement. So, and that hit people the wrong way, because their communications was terrible, because they then went on to say, look, we just have to move to AWS because none of you losers in Europe can do this. And then they said, look, we have a whole report that says how useless you all are. And then all these people said, look, you didn't ask. No one asked, because SIDN, just to realize, they run the .nl domain, which is surprisingly large, because Dutch people like buying cheap things. And so they have 6.5 million domain names, which is a lot. But SIDN is a wholesale. It's a registry, so they have 1,200 customers. So their effective statement was, no one in Europe can run a computer with 1,200 customers. And that was, of course, obviously not true. Combined with the fact that .nl, it's named after the country. It does sort of feel like a national thing. And to say this national thing, it's now so different, we no longer have the skills. We must have the Americans run this for us. Sort of, and that's why we're sort of becoming a US colony. We say we're under sort of foreign control. They tell us what technology we can use, and we cannot do it ourselves anymore.
So when you talk about, like, you know, if when you're talking about government regulations, before, you say an extreme case would be to say something like, you can only use EU cloud like services and things like this. But there is still, you're not there saying that we oughtn't to look in that direction. The internet community should look at, you know, making clear that those things can be done here. And
that's one thing. However, since that exploded, this news, I've luckily enough, for some reason, people like consulting my opinion, and even government people like doing that. So, and then in return, when they ask for my opinion, I like to really know what I'm talking about. So I started looking into this claim that no one in Europe can do this anymore.
Okay.
And there is, in a way, substantial truth to that. And on the one hand, we can say, look, we want to have legislation that things like .nl actually run in Europe. You can even be objective about this and say, look, it's not just nationalism. We do not want to fall under the US spying regulation, for example. On the other hand, we have indeed decided to leave the big cloud to other places. And I've taken a very hard and painful look at the European cloud offerings. And we've not been honest with ourselves here. So we can, for example, you can buy some pretty fine servers. You can hire pretty good servers in Europe. And you can even get a managed database up to a certain extent. But mainstay features of the cloud, like the Amazon S3 object store, no one in Europe offers that.
Really? Okay.
And it's painful because some listeners will say, we offer that. Take a harsh look at what you're offering. Because one of the best offerings I could find is limited in size to 1 terabyte.
Right.
or it's limited to one physical location. Or one of the French companies is proudly claiming that they have their own object store, which is even Amazon compatible, and then they tell you it's 99.9% available. That's not good. That's not good, because if that's your claim, you're probably not meeting that claim already. Right. So if you take a good look at what we are doing with the cloud in Europe, it's actually not good enough. And at that point, it's interesting that people have these legislative constraints going on. We say, we want to force you to buy this European stuff, but please also make better European stuff.
So until that happens, it's going to be the case that things flow towards AWS and things like that. And then it is interesting what you said in a couple of places about American law on privacy.
Yeah. So a little bit of context. Yesterday, so the US has a vast spying regime. And there's no use denying that, because you can just see how many billions of dollars they spend on it a year. It's a lot of billion dollars a year. And they're not setting that money on fire in a building of the NSA. They're actually putting that money to use. And it's many billions of dollars. And yesterday or 2 days ago in the US Congress, they passed a law that makes it like super easy for the US to spy on its own citizens. And this is new. This is sort of new. And it was sort of post 9/11, it was already. So before that, the way it works in US legislation is that non-Americans have no rights to privacy.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no protection under US law for you and me. And then they thought it was a little bit limiting, so they're now also making it very easy to spy on Americans. But and there's a little bit of uproar about that, but not that much, actually. So if you extrapolate from that they say, well, we can now just spy on Americans very easily.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine how low the bar is in the US for spying on Europeans? And it's not there. It's like we're not people. Actually, so in Europe, we have rules that, for Dutch spying laws, for example, do not contain the words the Netherlands or barely.
Yeah.
They're like, people have privacy and people have privacy.
Okay.
Whereas US law says Americans have a limited form of privacy. Or U.S. persons, as they call it. You can also become a U.S. person in different ways. But so it's good to be a U.S. person in that way. And we also know historically from the Snowden revelations how much spying was going on Angela Merkel and other people. And we have to operate under the assumption that if the Dutch houses of Parliament outsource their email to Microsoft, which they have done, so both houses of Dutch Parliament are now on the Microsoft 365 cloud. We have to operate under the assumption that the Americans like reading our government communications. And that's not a weird, because it's just you can just look at the facts. You can look at the history. You can look at the legislation. But it appears to be that we are operating under the assumption that they wouldn't do that. And the thing is, I would agree with that if the Dutch government, for example, would come out and say, look, we outsourced all our email to Microsoft, but we are sure that they will not look at it.
Mm-hmm.
We made an evaluation, we did a risk assessment, and we think that although they have the legal capability to look at it, even though they have the history of looking at it, even though they have the technical capability of looking at it, we are going to assume that they're not going to do it. And if they put that in writing, I would say, well, I disagree, but at least you put it in writing.
Yeah.
And now we're just not talking about it. And by the way, this is not just a Dutch thing. For example, the UK government have a 2013 document, so it's getting on in age, and where they said, look, everything to the cloud.
Yeah, okay.
So that's their policy. They may feel a little bit closer to the US in these terms, and maybe they can get an exemption from the spying, maybe. But it's not just a Dutch thing. It's just a more generic thing where people are not realist. I mean, and if, let's say you have a shoe store and you outsource your shoe store filings and administration to Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably fine.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not going to sit there in the US and go like, hey, we need to keep track of all shoes being sold in Amsterdam.
Sure.
But once you are a government, I think it's a bit weird that governments are now discussing their Microsoft policies own Microsoft servers.
Yeah.
It's weird. But it's, but, and getting back to George Orwell, he, one of the other things he wrote about, that there are the, how difficult it is to see what's in front of your nose.
Mm-hmm.
Facing unpleasant facts, he called that. And we sort of have a blind spot. Once something becomes absurd enough, like you are discussing your policy towards the United States on United States servers, we're like, yeah, it's probably fine. It's probably fine.
The internet was never designed for any of this stuff. And we talk about this in terms of BGP. It was never designed for security. And DNS wasn't really designed to be private. So is this all just kind of inevitable as soon as you get the internet spinning away? You know?
Yeah. So the thing is, you talk about control.
Yeah.
And control has to do with the desire to be in control. And many things have drifted. So I love reading history books. And for example, you see that monopolies or technical tricks to create monopolies are like thousands of years old. It is, I think, to some extent inevitable that if you could buy something from many different places and one of these places is superficially more attractive than the other, then they get more business.
Yeah.
They become bigger. They get even more business. So inevitably, you end up in places where you have these quasi-monopolies simply because we can buy this stuff from anywhere.
Yeah.
Which means that your business can drift away to places over which you have no control. We didn't do that for cars, for example. We said, look, if you want to drive a car on a European road, it has to adhere to European standards. You cannot take an American car and put it on US on European roads.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, that goes both ways. There are safety things that are mandatory in the US that are optional here, and the other way around. And even some environmental things, like the catalytic converter that we got, that was mandatory in the US, like decades before it became mandatory. But cars are, they're the legislation is local.
Mm-hmm.
We said these are the rules for the cars on our road. Doesn't matter where they get made.
Yeah.
And for the internet, we sort of didn't do that.
Yeah,
we're playing catch up now, but I think that the internet, it's not really the internet's fault that capitalism happens.
No, okay, yeah.
And in fact, it is interesting that the internet is still, to some extent, open. So, for example, if I open a data center and I have a lot of content, then I will be able to bring that to the internet.
Mm-hmm.
But I only need to bring money. Email is closed now. So if I decide to run my own mail server, which I happen to do, that is a hit and miss affair. Because randomly, Microsoft and Google will start discarding all your email. And they will say, oh, sorry, there was a spammer within a 25-mile neighborhood of your server. So we disabled all delivery. And by the way, you can also not talk to us.
Yeah.
And so I think the internet is, to some extent, still remarkably open, as long as you're not doing email.
Mm-hmm.
Or need IPv4 addresses.
Speaking of complex systems that we don't have much control over, you've also written about climate change.
It crosses over a little bit. So we have these huge data centers.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've done any serious programming, you know that the computer program can exist roughly in three modes.
Okay.
One mode is like terrifyingly slow, and it's not suitable. You cannot scale this. It's suitable for office use, but it's... And that means that if you are going to scale it that way, you're going to need a whole data center full of servers.
Yeah.
Then there's a sort of middle ground that says, look, this software, it's pretty good. It performs as we would hope it would.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is what I like to call is the miracle worker.
Yeah.
And for example, the miracle worker, Netflix is a great example. And Akamai, they have focused relentlessly on how many gigabits of traffic can we generate per server.
Mm-hmm.
And the amount of data that Netflix is able to spew from a server is tremendous. I mean, they can fill your pipes with like three servers, which is nice because it saves money, but it's also wonderful for the environment. Because so they paid more money to programmers, and instead and now they have fewer servers.
Yeah.
It's a great deal. Between these three modes that I sort of described are each a factor of 10.
Okay.
And in case of Netflix, maybe even a factor of 100. Because if you would naively get a server and try to stream images, I think you would get 1% of the performance that Netflix gets. I see this a lot now. We have this cloud that we talked about, and it's very easy to scale stuff in the cloud. Which means that if your stuff is inefficient, it just becomes more expensive because it starts requiring more cores and more servers, which is again emitting more CO2 and it's like terrible stuff. Mm-hmm. In the olden days, when the dinosaurs roamed the earth, if my stuff was not fast enough for the server, I would have to go through a difficult procurement process to get a second server.
Mm.
It would have been easier for me to just program a little more efficiently because that would probably have been faster. And that incentive is gone right now.
Yeah.
And I've very personally experienced that with the PowerDNS migration, where we had a big telco, millions of customers, and they had 6 name servers before the migration, 6
yeah.
physical servers, which is like 2 million users per server.
Mm.
This is good stuff. Then the migration to a fully virtualized, software-defined network world happened where nothing is real anymore.
Mm.
So these old servers, like 6 servers combined to like honest called switches. They were like connected, transistors connected straight to the internet. And the replacement was this whole virtualized thingamajig. And it turned out when we started with 6 servers, we ended up using more than 1,000 cores.
Wow.
Of CPU power,
yeah,
to service the same needs, and that got lost. I mean, and now it's all modern and auto-scaling and clouds native and stuff. But yeah, it does require 1,000 cores now,
yeah,
which is doing the environment no favors. So one thing I would really love to see, and it has to come maybe from us, the geeks, write more efficient software.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let it scale through the invoice. Really try hard, see if is the software doing what it should be doing, isn't it doing too much. Write minimal software that's smaller, because it's not just cooler and more secure, it's actually, you could achieve a factor of 10 performance improvement.
Yeah.
And I think many people are programming know that. And not only does it feel good to make your stuff 10 times as fast, you can feel even better at saving 90% CO2
mm-hmm.
emissions. So that's one hope I have. That, and we will probably have to do it in secret as nerds, because for some reason, spending money on Amazon is sort of cheaper for some reason than giving your programmers a few more weeks of time.
Do you think the internet community as a whole is talking about this enough, though?
Yeah, no one asks us. So I think we have less and less freedom as technical people, and we are more and more managed and time-boxed and whatever.
Mm.
And so it's more difficult for us to do this because, and in many places, like I said, many IT projects are failures. So if you have something that works but is like hella expensive to run, many companies are going to be, well, let's do that for a while,
mm-hmm.
And just spend the big money, and yeah, well, we'll live with it, and because it works. It
yeah.
works, man. And,
yeah.
and there is so much stuff that doesn't work. So if you come along and say, hey, I want to make your stuff 2 times as efficient, but it's going to be a little bit rough around the edges, they go like, no, not doing that.
Sure.
It's going to continue killing the environment.
Okay. I don't want to end on those words, but like this talk about controlling the internet and or keeping control of the internet in some sense, it's such like a broad concept. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of what we're talking about here is just about kind of understanding how things actually work, like maintaining that understanding as the people who are responsible for making the internet. And it seems to be that like when you lose touch with understanding how the things actually work, that's when the problems start
yeah.
to happen, right? And like that seems to be a real thread through your work of maintaining that understanding and articulating that back to governments, to like company, what
yeah, you know. Higher ups.
Yeah.
I think we could do a lot better job. So I think there's some kind of alienation going on where the technical people have not been invited to the meetings where the big decisions get taken, or they didn't show up.
Yeah.
I think as a community, we could do a far better job at not just telling what the higher ups should not be doing, but also selling what we could do.
Yeah.
So, for example, if you could say I'm against Amazon and I don't want to have all this outsourcing to Azure or whatever, that's the negative way. And the positive way is, hey, we worked really hard and now it fits on one server or it fits on fewer Amazon servers. And we're also fine with that. But I think we should do, so we have this Dutch NL-NOC meeting. And there, for the past 10 years, I've done 3 presentations on sort of employee career development and stuff.
Yeah.
And one of these is really how do we sell ourselves as nerds, as technical people? And I would love if anyone, like, I cannot change the opinion of my company. Well, it's probably true. But if you study a little bit how decisions get made,
mm-hmm.
You might be, and I think you would succeed in bending a few more decisions in the right direction.
Yeah.
Because one key message is the people in boardrooms, they are not all idiots. And actually, some of them are like really smart, just in ways that we don't immediately appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if we could close that gap, because we're radicalized. Because it seems like the people at the higher end of an organization, they would love to have like no technology. And then you have the technical people that love doing technology.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of tension between these two worlds. But if we could come together a little bit more and say, hey, if you own this technology, your profit margin could go up. You could actually innovate. You could do other things that people are not doing.
Yeah.
And then everything would become better. So that is my hope, maybe sometimes, that we not just keep on hating on each other,
mm-hmm.
but that, because we're in this together.
Yeah.
I mean, so that would be my hope.
Great.
For the future.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Bert.
Yeah.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
That's our episode. If you enjoyed it, please remember to like and subscribe on whatever platform you're using to listen to this. As usual, you'll find loads of relevant links in the show notes. My thanks once again to Bert, and we'll see you next time on the Ribe Labs podcast.